Committee on Consumer Protection to order for the Oregon Legislature. It is Wednesday, April the 4th, 2007. And today we have four public hearings, four different bills, and we're probably going to jump around a little bit due to accommodate the schedules of some other legislators who want to testify, but don't know when they're going to be here exactly. So with that, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2008. Steve, give us a brief summary of the bill, please.
Thank you, Chair Holvey. House Bill 2008 establishes a Bill of Rights for telecommunications consumers.
Thank you. And first up, if we could, if Rick Willis would be so kind.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Rick Willis with the Public Utility Commission. The commission philosophically, conceptually, supports the ideas in House Bill 2008. Certainly the commission is always for increased consumer protection. Excuse me. However, there's a couple of issues in this bill that we think are unclear and could use a little more refining. It's my understanding there's been some discussion about putting together a work group to work on some of these issues. And the commission would certainly be happy to participate in that work group. That's about all I had to say, Mr. Chair. If I can answer any questions. Sort of, yeah.
You almost shocked me. So, is there any questions on this bill? Representative Gerard.
Not to put you on the spot, but okay. It's a pretty short bill. What's unclear and where?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gerard, there's a couple of areas. In subsection 5, for example, talks about consumer have a right to accurate and understandable bill. We're not quite sure what understandable means, what understandable to one person may not be understandable to another. So I think that needs a little more clearing up. Has a right to courteous customer assistance, again. How do we define that? What does that mean? Section 7 talks about safety and security for persons and property. That's getting into an area that the PUC really hasn't been in before and, again, would like to know a little more about just what that means and what it is we would enforce in that area. So there's several areas like that that we think could be clarified a bit more.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for the PUC, Representative Nelson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Wilson, do other states do this? I've never known us to do something like this.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I believe that California tried to do a Bill of Rights. I think they had one. It was in and it was out. I don't know where it stands today, but they tried to put one together. I'm not sure of other examples. That's the one I'm most familiar with is California did have one for a time, but I think they repealed it.
Follow up. And Mr. Wilson, do you see a need for this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, the commission certainly supports consumer protection. I can say that in the area of telecommunications, there is another bill that is being worked on that I believe will come to this committee shortly that deals with telecommunications and in a broader context, but part of that will deal with consumer rights. So while we do think there is room for enhanced consumer protection, this other bill may take care of some of those. That's the problem with having competing bills going back and forth, but I hope that answers your question.
One last follow-up, please.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Wilson, do we have standards set? Do you have standards set for communications companies, for example, you know, as we talked about what practices, you know, fair, good practices are, quality practices. Do you have standards for them and for the state?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, we do. We have a number of standards, service quality standards, or what we call them. This bill goes beyond those in that our service quality standards apply to the regulated phone companies. This bill, it looks to us like it goes beyond just the regulated phone companies. That is one of the other questions to answer Representative Gerard. Some of the part that's unclear who all this applies to. As we read it right now, potentially it could apply to more than just those regulated companies. So this is somewhat broader, potentially.
No further questions for you.
Oh, quick question.
Representative Gilliam, of course.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
How did I miss you?
I don't know. It's Mr. Willis, right?
Yes.
How do we communicate service quality standards to consumers? Is it by inquiry, or are there other kinds of mailers or dissemination of information?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, we do it in several ways. We have pamphlets that we prepare and get out in a number of different forms. We put them out, as well as we share them with the AG's office because they have a consumer protection section. They share them with folks as well. They're on our website, so folks can see them through there. And certainly anybody who calls in, we share that information with them, and we discuss them at public commission meetings.
Thank you.
No further questions. Thank you, Mr. Willis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next up, I have Larry Campbell. See if I can get somebody else to come up with him here. Is anybody willing?
Remember last time he was here?
I don't see anybody getting up, Mr. Chair.
I'll be kind, Representative Nelson. Nobody else. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Larry Campbell. I'm here representing General Motors and our subsidiary, OnStar. Mr. Willis just made a comment about others may be included in this, and maybe not intentionally, but certainly that's one of our concerns. With the help of the committee chair, I requested amendments on 32007. And we still haven't received them, but I'm sure that we will find them in the near future. But what I've done is I've included the amendment that we're asking for at the bottom of my testimony. And General Motors and its wholly owned subsidiary, OnStar, strive to make products and services desirable and valuable for our customers. But we basically have a prepaid arrangement. For example, the first year that you have OnStar, it's part of the cost of your car. In the second year, you're contacted and asked if you want to continue it. And if you are, you're asked for your credit card number. And, for example, we have OnStar in our car. And each month, the amount of our OnStar charges are withheld from our credit card. The other thing is if we want additional minutes, all we do is push our OnStar button, say we'd like an additional 100 minutes, and they say that'll cost you X number of dollars, and may we have your credit card, and we give them a credit card, and that's the way it's charged. So if we indeed were included in this bill, which we believe we are by the way it's written, we would find it necessary to redo all of our billing processes for OnStar. So I think I checked the box that said we will oppose this bill unless there's an amendment. We have no other reason to oppose it, but we do feel very strongly that we do not want to go through a process of changing all of our billing arrangements in order to meet the needs identified in this bill. And I'd be more than happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Campbell, I heard that you were by my office looking for amendments. Did I drop the ball on these amendments, or did you turn
Mr. Chairman.
Them in? Did you turn them in or did I? I don't remember.
I think we're joint conspirators, Mr. Chairman.
Well, we'll try to follow up and see where they're at. Because quite frankly, I don't know where they're at.
Neither do I.
Yeah.
I'm not sure alleged counsel does either, Mr. Chairman.
Well, we'll figure it out.
Thank you very much.
What happens if in fact, we move this bill any further forward. Okay, thank you. Oh, questions? Okay. Representative Nelson.
Yes, thank you. Mr. Campbell, when I'm looking at this amendment where you say insert, and I'm looking at the bill, customers have a right to accurate. So just what you're saying is consumers who are billed.
Yes, ma'am.
Only those type of consumers for products and services that they authorize and a right to fair profit. So that is the only issue?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, yes, that is the only issue. What this does is it excludes anybody that does pre-billing. In other words, it doesn't have a bill.
So billed consumers is what we want to say. Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much.
Thank you. No further questions for Mr. Campbell. Okay. Thank you for your testimony. Next up, Bob Jinks. And anybody that would like to join him? I'd offer that up.
It's all my friends.
We'll be right on. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Jenks. I'm Executive Director of the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon. I'm pleased to be here in support of House Bill 2008 today. We look at the bill as a simple, straightforward bill, and would like to make a comment. If the telecom industry was as simple and straightforward as this bill, there wouldn't be any need for this bill. But it is necessary. Attached to my testimony, whoops, I didn't leave all of it. Attached to my testimony is a chart that shows the complaints to the Attorney General over the last 5 years. And during the last 5 years, during five of the last 6 years, telecom complaints have topped the Attorney General's list of complaints. The only year that it did not top that list was 2005, and in that year it was number two. It's not a surprise to me that telecom complaints are the top of that list. Because of my job, I hear about them all the time, and I would challenge any one of you folks, if you want to know the problem, next time you're at a potluck dinner, social event, reception, simply ask around. Ask people if they have telecommunications horror stories, and you will find that Oregonians, by and large, have telecommunications horror stories. And this bill goes to the heart of those complaints. It states that consumers have a right to get clear and complete information about rates. Consumers can only be charged the rates that they agree to pay. It's common to see promotional materials right now for telecommunications services and products that don't list the actual prices that people will be billed. Like many Oregonians, I've had my own consumer problems with this industry. Once I was billed for a DSL modem that had been offered as a free promotional item. And then the company, when I refused to pay for my free modem, threatened to cut off my telephone service, even though Oregon law does not allow them to disconnect telephone service for the lack of payment of an unassociated charge. I've also had a problem with my wireless phone. When I tried to add a second phone line on for my wife, I was charged twice the rate that the service rep had promised me. When I challenged this, I was told if I wanted to get out of it, I would have to pay a significant early termination fee. It was only after I threatened to file a complaint with the Attorney General's office and take them to small claims court for $10 a month that the company made good on the amount of money that their department had told me I would be charged for the service. This bill is necessary because those kinds of experiences are not uncommon. But most people don't have my ability to fight back. They don't know the Attorney General process. They don't know their current rights under the law. This bill changes that. It sets a set of standards in Oregon law that customers have a right to accurate information. They have a right to be charged with their promise. They have a right to expect personal information will be protected. And they have a right to non-discriminatory prices. The bill sends an important message to the industry, an industry that seems to have no problem being number one on the Attorney General's list year after year. It's time for the telecommunications industry to clean up its act. Rather than downplay the problem, it's time to address the problem. Customers should be treated with the respect that this bill tries to twice to put into law. I acknowledge and I agree with Mr. Willis that there are some issues with this bill. I think a lot of the terms aren't defined in it. There needs to be definitions. There needs to be some clear enforcement mechanism that's articulated in it. And I recognize that those are issues. Like Mr. Willis, I would offer Cubs help in any kind of work group to amend this bill if the committee would like to see this bill reworked as something to go forward. I also agree with Mr. Willis that there's a separate bill that's going to deal with some of the consumer issues and consumer complaint process at the Public Utility Commission. We obviously, if that's the vehicle people would like to see to address consumer problems, then we're more than happy to put our time into that bill. But we think consumer complaints do need to be dealt with by one of the bills this session. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? Representative Nelson.
Yes, thank you. I'm sorry I called Mr. Willis Mr. Wilson. let me see if I can ruin your name, too. Mr. Jenks?
That's good.
That's good. All right. What would be an appropriate enforcement action in something like this? I have no clue.
To me, the first enforcement mechanism that we think is viable is the PUC Consumer Complaint Division. Right now, that handles primarily regulated phone companies, though with agreement with the Attorney General handles wireless services. And they do a good job. Consumers have a problem. They can call that complaint division. That complaint division can help tell them what their rights are. It's got a backdoor channel to the various phone companies that it regulates to get actions. Oftentimes it's simply getting somebody who's not a sales agent, but somebody who can say, yes, we'll meet our promise to this customer, and the PUC can help them do that. So our general belief is the first step of enforcement shouldn't be litigation, but should be the Consumer Complaint Division of the PUC being able to take these complaints and help the customer resolve them. Only if they can't be resolved should then legal lawyers or other folks become involved.
And so thus, if this company does not protect my rights that I have my telecommunication system with, and I have to go to court, would it be fair that this telecommunications company or the loser thereof pays the attorney fees and some kind of fine?
Under that, I think the first thing most consumers want when they address these is they want to get the bill that they asked for. They want to get a lot of this is billing practices, and people want to get charged the price they agreed to pay for it. And I think courts aren't the best enforcement mechanism, to be honest, because you're dealing with $10 a month, $20 a month, and asking a court and attorneys that charge fees that are quite a bit higher than that per hour isn't the best way to resolve those. But to the degree they do go to court, then if there's no other way to get things resolved in our society, ultimately that is where things oftentimes end up. To be honest, I'm not an attorney. My background is economics, so I don't know. I would imagine this is dealt with the civil enforcement of other rights that people have in the state.
Mm-hmm. Further questions? Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. in your testimony, you talked about your bill that was they charged you the wrong amount, and the only way you were able to get it changed was to threaten to go to the Attorney General or and then you said this bill would change all that. And I think it's a good bill, don't get me wrong. But I fail to see how it will change that, because if the people don't know that this bill exists, just like they don't know that the current rules exist, they won't know where to go.
Right. No, I think you're right. I may have oversimplified things. Currently, there you have certain rights that grow out of the State Corrupt Practices Act that say that are enforced by the Attorney General with regard to advertisements, promotions, and prices and things like that. Nowhere does that act state in common language that I think consumers understand that if somebody promised you a certain price, you get it. So I think by clarifying, I mean, a consumer, you're right, if they don't know about this, doesn't do them any good. If they know about this law gives them some fairly clear language on what they have a right to expect and what they have a right to demand. Not a lot of consumers can read the Corrupt Practices Act of the State of Oregon that applies to all businesses and sort of interpret what their rights are that grow out of that and then fight with those with one of these phone companies. And that's the real issue where I think by sort of separating these out, in many respects, these are the rights that exist under the Corrupt Practices Act, but this makes clear what they are and what people's expectations and puts them in sort of the consumer's language, and I think that helps and changes things there.
Quick follow-up.
Follow-up, please.
So basically the main point of this bill is to put it in plain language, is that right?
I think it puts it in plain language and makes clear that those rights exist rather than people arguing about whether state law does require these things.
Thank you.
So.
Thank you for testifying for us today.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Next up, I'd like to have Elise Brown, and anyone else would like to join her?
They like the women.
She has friends.
Mr. Campbell didn't have any friends here. And the smart one didn't come with him this time.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. I'm Brant Wolf with the Oregon Telecommunications Association. Basically, we agree with a lot of what's been said today. The principles that they're laid out in the bill, we don't find objectionable. We agree to them, and we strive every day to implement them and to make sure that our customers are given all these rights and accommodations that the bill lays out. However, as you've heard in previous testimony on other consumer-related bills like this, we feel this bill is redundant and unnecessary. And not to be too theatrical, but when I came before this committee before this, I kind of discussed that and indicated that, and this time I brought all of them with me for show and tell if you want to see all of it. This orange book is all the laws that relate to regulated utilities, not just telecommunications, but all of them, but we're a big part of this. And then this other binder here is all the rules that implement the laws. So there are plenty of laws and rules and regulations to deal with all kinds of issues that consumers might come up against with the telecommunications company. And basically, that's about it. You've got my testimony to get to some of the questions we heard today. Behind my written testimony, I went to the PUC website today and I printed out one company's service quality report. That's Cascade Utilities. It's not the only good one. I didn't print just the good one. It's just the first one that appeared alphabetically. These service quality measures that's one of the small companies, but the larger companies are there as well, Verizon and Quest, et cetera. They report these standards and measurements every month, and the PUC updates them every month on their website. It's very easy to find. You can go there yourself and see it all you want. To Mr. Jeans's point about telecommunications numbers being the highest, I think I would like to see the numbers that he submitted, because I recognize that there are more contacts for telecommunications companies, but I'm not sure that those are all complaints. They're information kinds of contacts, and to be sure, some of them are complaints, but I think the vast majority are not. There's been talk of a work group. If that's the will of the legislature, obviously we would be happy to sit at the table and be part of that. I, however, would object to just having a generic kind of slap on the wrist workshop when no need has been demonstrated for that kind of a work group. And basically, that's the sum of my testimony. We feel the bill is unnecessary, it's redundant, and we would hope that the committee not pass this bill out. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have about my testimony or anything else that you'd like to talk about relating to this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to move on with the rest of the panel. That we're kind of running behind schedule now, and we have a representative waiting.
Sure. Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Elise Brown representing Singular Wireless, the new AT&T. And we're here today to oppose House Bill 2008 also for the reason that we believe the issues that have all been raised thus far are already being addressed by the wireless industry. I, too, brought some show and tell, and hopefully I'll walk through that in just a second. Wireless industry currently has policies and practices today right now that keep our customers well-informed, treated fairly, and their privacy is protected. One of those has already been mentioned by Rick Willis, and that is the legal authority that the Attorney General has. It's called the Assurance of Voluntary Compliance, and since 2004, the wireless industry, many of the carriers in Oregon, have signed on to a legal agreement with the AG in Oregon and with 32 other attorney generals across the country. And this agreement protects consumers in a variety of ways, including disclosure of rates, terms and conditions, taxes, and just so you know, the AG currently now has the authority to bring legal action if any one of us are in violation of that. The second piece is the industry policing itself, and the handout I brought for you today, I'd like for you to see. It's the CTIA Code of Wireless Service. We call it the Code of Conduct, and you could even call it the Ten Commandments. But you can see there some of the policies that we adhere to and interface with our customers on. I won't read through all of those, but the best way to detail that is the last piece that I brought with you is the AT&T Customer Service Summary. And I think to Bob Jenks's statements, and those printed in the bill that the customer has a right to this, that, and the other thing is really clearly demonstrated in this document. And just so we don't miss any of that, I'm going to go through just a few of the highlights, but you walk in, and these are available at the point of purchase in any one of Singular Wireless's stores across the state of Oregon. So at the time I go in to buy my phone, I'm up at the desk, and I can get a printout, and this is what you receive at our store location, that clearly goes through everything at the time of purchase. I think the most amazing thing is people can understand and see what their first bill looks like. The first bill always looks a little different than the others in that there's the activation fee, so the amount of the first bill is higher than what subsequent bills will look like. So it's really nice to be able to show that to the customer what they'd expect. This is also where we have the opportunity to explain some of the taxes that are tacked on to their monthly bill. The other piece of it that you hear from time to time that register on the complaint list is coverage issues. And now at our store and even available on our Singular Wireless website, we have what we call a mapping tool. And you can, with a system at the counter there, type in your street address, home address, work address, and know exactly at that moment what the coverage looks like, whether Singular is going to be a good buy for you or whether you go to T-Mobile or somebody else. So I think that's amazing. We can offer that to the customer at the point of purchase. If it doesn't look good, they go someplace else. So this is just a demonstration. This is Singular's example. Everybody has a different way that they illustrate the code of ethics to their customer base. But this is just to demonstrate to you that we take customer service very, very seriously in the competitive environment that we're all living in now. So that's my testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Drew Hagedorn for T-Mobile USA. I know you're running short on time, so I'll just echo the remarks of my colleagues. T-Mobile also has resources available online, et cetera, just as Elise mentioned Singular AT&T has. In addition, I actually have in front of me the numbers for 2006, the PUC complaint numbers that were referenced earlier. And remember, too, that there are over 2 million wireless telecommunications customers. And for the wireless industry, there were a number of, 653 total complaints, what they call complaints, what I would really describe as inquiries. Of those, only two were considered at fault. 44 of those were considered at fault, no jurisdiction. So we're talking about a minute, less than one half of 1% complaint rate. So I just wanted to clarify that for the record. And thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I'll take any questions.
Go ahead.
Representative Rosenbaum, are you on a tight time schedule?
I have another committee meeting right now.
Okay. Well, I'm going to dispense with the questions, and maybe we'll call you back up after we hear from Representative Rosenbaum. Thank you. Representative Rosenbaum, please. And Representative, we're under House Bill 2008, and if you'd like to deliver testimony to that, I will then close the hearing and open up the hearing on 2836.
And I'm primarily here to talk about 2836. So.
Okay.
I do support 2008, but that's not what I came to talk about.
With that, I will close the public hearing on 2008 and open a public hearing on, where'd it go? 2836.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I am Diane Rosenbaum, State Representative for House District 42, and am a chief sponsor together with the chair of this committee on House Bill 2836. I just wanted to briefly tell you what the bill does. It's really very simple, and then tell you about why I think it's an important piece of legislation. This bill basically deals with call centers and says that if you are either contacted by or place a call into one of these call centers, that within 30 seconds after beginning the conversation, the person that takes your call has to identify themselves as well as the employer that they're working for, and then also, and this would be a new requirement, disclose the location of where they are physically located. In addition to that, the bill says that any personal financial information or medical information that is elicited from you cannot be provided to an overseas call center without your express permission. So that's essentially what the bill does. Why? It's really about two things. It's about consumer protection and privacy, and it's also about jobs. And I can tell you that I've had many experiences myself of talking to people who were clearly didn't know anything. And I was thinking just now of when I was stranded at the Chicago airport waiting for a flight to get back to Portland, coming home from an NCSL meeting, and all day long I had been calling trying to get the status of the flight because there were blizzard conditions, and never once did I get anybody that was in the United States. And finally I was at the airport, at the gate, talking to people who were in India, and not that there's anything wrong with India, I'm sure that these are fine folks, but they kept telling me as I was sitting there, oh, yes, ma'am, the plane is leaving on time. And I would look out the window at this blizzard, and there were no planes on the ground anywhere. And I would say, but that can't be true because I'm sitting here at the gate, and there's no plane in sight. And they would say, that's what the computer says. And then I would ask to talk to a supervisor and be told exactly the same thing. So I'm sure that you all have had similar experiences. I think that the bill is important in that there are 20,000 Oregonians at last count who worked at call centers here. You have, I think, in front of you written testimony from Madeline Elder, who was going to be here at the previous hearing but could not be here today, talking about the people that she represents. She's the president of the Communications Workers of America, and that they've basically lost half of their membership, and that's primarily because of the outsourcing of all of these jobs that were formerly located in Oregon. So I think that, you know, it really is a twofold problem, but, you know, this wouldn't prohibit that outsourcing from taking place. It would just basically let people know that they're talking to somebody who's not here, and if you don't want your private medical information or financial information being given out, then you have the right to say no, or they have to ask for your permission before being able to do that. And so that's essentially what the bill does, and I would hope that you would give it favorable consideration. I think there are a lot of people out there that would appreciate it, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
questions from the committee? Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Rosenbaum. At the bottom of the front of the page where it talks about if the call center is in a foreign country, the person may request that the call be rerouted to a customer sales call center or customer service call center located in the United States. But what if the company doesn't have a call center left in the United States? Then what happens?
Well, then I assume that they would have to contract with somebody here at in the United States that does have a call center here. And this actually has come up, although the bill wouldn't apply to state agencies, but I know that there was a pretty well-publicized occurrence where the state of Oregon was having food stamp calls answered by a company that had outsourced the work overseas, and the governor actually intervened using his executive power and was able to bring those calls back into the United States. So, I mean, there may be some companies that have no presence at all in the United States, but if so, then they could contract with an employer that did operate call centers here, and that's largely what they're doing anyway, is contracting with somebody. So,
thank you.
Further questions for Representative Rosenbaum? Representative Nelson.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Diane, I have a huge amount of information that was put together by my aide, and I'll just give it to you privately about there are several different issues that he sees in this. He's this lawyer person. Mm-hmm. But I want to ask you, when you talk about protection, privacy, you know, one of my biggest concerns in this state is that we're using our state penitentiaries as call centers. And so talk about privacy. I think it shouldn't begin at home.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nelson, I think that that's an interesting point. The bill actually does not apply because the statute that we're dealing with in amending doesn't apply to governmental entities, but that certainly is an issue that I'm sure there are concerns about.
Thank you. Any other questions for Representative Rosenbaum? I don't see any. Thank you very much for your testimony and bringing the bill forward.
Thank you very
Appreciate
much
it.
For hearing that.
Have a good afternoon. And with that, I'm going to close the hearing just briefly on House Bill 2836 and reopen the hearing on House Bill 2008. And Andrea Meyer, please.
Good afternoon, Chair, members of the committee. Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon. I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 2008. In particular, we are very concerned about the issues of customers' rights to personal privacy and Section 2, Subsection 3's inclusion of the right to protection from unauthorized use of consumer records and personal information. As you may or may not recall, back in May of 06, there were news reports about the release of customer telephone information to the National Security Agency without court order or warrants of any kind. This was covered extensively nationally, and the ACLU, 19 affiliates in addition to the Oregon affiliate, and National ACLU filed actions in our states, either with the Public Utility Commissions or the Attorney General or both, seeking to get answers to whether or not customer information had been turned over without court authorization. We didn't ask for anything beyond that for disclosure of who, what, where, when, why, but simply did it happen. We have yet to get an answer. And I want to be clear. Our intentions are not and never are to seek to obstruct legitimate law enforcement activities, but simply to ensure that the protections are and the law is actually followed. To date, Verizon has refused to tell us. Quest has refused to tell us. And when I say us, it's not just the ACLU. Over 1,700 Oregonians joined a petition to which we filed and included in our complaint to the Public Utility Commission of Oregon. But one telephone company did, they actually were able to say, no, we have not, and it's not our policy, nor have we actually provided to any agency without court order. And that was United Telephone Company and BARC. So it is possible to do, and it was done. And when we filed an amended complaint, we did not include them because they had answered the question we, an Oregonian, sought to know. Now, previous testimony said that telephone companies here, we have policies and practices to assure and keep customer information private. Well, we don't have adequate remedy and adequate Oregon law because we believe when I can't even ask my telephone company, have you turned over my information to a court or without a court order or anyone's information, that they those policies and practices do not adequately protect us. We think there needs to be a remedy and a clear right in Oregon law. The PUC action is still going on. They've held it in abeyance until resolution of a Ninth Circuit case. The Attorney General, as was mentioned that the Attorney General has authority, refused to investigate. So consumers, Oregonians, are left without an answer. And I think with the answers we've received or the lack of answers we've received from some of the telecommunication companies, Oregonians are not adequately protected and that their private information is not protected from impermissible disclosures to third parties without a court order. So we urge you to move forward with legislation that would provide all Oregonians adequate protections in law. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Thank you very much for your testimony today. I appreciate it. With that, I'd like to close the public hearing on House Bill 2008 and reopen the hearing on House Bill 2836. First up, I have Jim Craven.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jim Craven, representing the American Electronics Association. We're a national trade association that represents the high-tech industry, both in computer and other equipment manufacturer, software industry, and internet types of companies. I want to say, first of all, that I do represent the American Electronics Association. I'm not here representing offshore call centers per se or any foreign entity or interest. And I also want to say that I don't think the comments I'm going to make on this bill are anything terribly unique to the high-tech industry. In conversations the last couple of weeks with many of my colleagues in the building, I think there are a whole bunch of business sectors that will share our skepticism about this bill. Apparently have been deputized today to deliver that generic message, so I'll do the best I can. We think that 2836 is overly broad, probably unnecessary, probably doesn't achieve the goal that the sponsors hope for it to achieve. And we also think it's an unwarranted intrusion upon the ability of private sector companies to conduct their business and serve their customers. It's overly broad in the sense that it not only regulates incoming calls, say a person calling you to sell you something, it does also regulate outgoing calls, a call that a consumer places on his or her own motion to either get technical service, purchase something, make a hotel reservation, plane reservation, etc. So I think it's pretty broad in that it's important to realize this isn't just a restriction on people who are calling you, cold calling you to sell you something. It is a two-way street. And it also, the specifics of the bill do impact all call centers, even call centers located in Oregon. The disclosures that one needs to make and the specific scripts that one needs to follow are not just targeted at offshore or foreign call centers. They will, in some ways, disrupt the ability of companies who are actually here in Oregon in the call center business. We already have a statute that regulates sort of cold calls. It's referenced in the bill. We're on line 14. It says, in addition to the requirements of ORS, ORS 646611 is a statute that's been on the books since 1979, and that is a statute. It sort of mimics the language here in the bill, where it's, and it says that within 30 seconds of initiating a sales call, you must identify yourself, the person that you represent, explain the purpose of the call, provide a description of what you're calling for, terminate the call upon request. So for the sake of people calling you to bother you or sell you something, we already have a statute that sets out parameters for that. We also, of course, have the do not call list. And so people who don't want to get calls from commercial entities can place themselves on the federal do not call list and not get those calls. Where the bill, I think, does start getting focus is, of course, on trying to put limits on the use of companies in the United States to use foreign call centers and to try to dictate the specific scripts those call centers would use and how they interact with their customers. As Representative Bonamici pointed out at the bottom of the bill and the top of the second page, it says that a consumer has the ability to request that their call be transferred to a U.S.-based call center, and it says that upon such request, the call center operator, quote, shall attempt to reroute the call. And then there's a period, and that's all it says. So it does not and probably cannot require companies to put their call centers in any specific part of the globe. And all it says is that shall attempt to. Well, if you don't have a domestic call center, then you can't attempt to, and so the attempt would fail. And so that would be that as far as the language of this bill. I don't see how that statute or that this proposal does anything to create an Oregon job or a U.S. job, in that it basically says you have the right to say, I want to talk to an American, and the way I read the bill says the operator has the right to say, sorry, no can do. That's the way I read the bill. I think the most troubling part of the bill is on the second page, which is the boldface type sub 4. And I think you heard from the sponsor that this seems to say that you cannot transfer personal financial information to an offshore call center if you're a customer in Oregon. And I think the implications of this are just huge in the sense of Oregon customers being able to book a hotel room, make a plane reservation, buy things on, you know, over the phone, or receive, you know, technical assistance. I think it also, you know, it says unless you submit written authorization to do so, which means you're in a hurry to book a room for a weekend away, and you'd have to send written authorization information. That's Representative Ryan and I've had a conversation, and I think he reads it slightly different. That's what I heard in the presentation on the bill as the intent. So I do think this is mainly designed perhaps to disrupt people's business model or to, you know, in a sense, create a little bit of harassment. I don't see how it actually creates jobs in Oregon or in the U.S. I think finally it... I do believe that it has the potential, the very real potential, of actually disrupting customer protection, disrupting the ability of customers to get needed services. And I really don't think that companies that have availed themselves of call center operations wherever they've done it in the globe are probably going to adjust their business model to serve three area codes in Oregon, which is about 1% of the U.S. economy, and I'm not sure what the fraction is of the global economy. So while perhaps well-intended, I think there's lots of problems with this bill, and I think they're shared by a lot of folks in the business sector as to whether there's actually a need for this and whether how it would really work in reality. So, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Riley, a quick question?
Two things that were in your testimony that I'd like to question. One was this is not about, this is about a customer not being able, me making a call And my take on that is, yeah, I'm making a call, and it'd be good if I know where I'm making the call to. And that's something that you kind of brushed over. But the main point is, as you pointed out, I have a different reading of this subsection 4, and it fairly clearly states a customer call center or customer service call center cannot send that information. It doesn't say I can't send that information while I'm on the phone. If I want to give that information, I certainly can. What it says is this business can't send that information overseas without my permission.
Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, we had this conversation privately. I think it's perhaps inelegantly drafted. I've wrestled with trying to understand that language myself. It rests on the phrase "may not send to," and I'm not really sure what the intent is in the way it's drafted. I thought I heard in the sponsor's presentation that we need to make sure that we keep all of our financial information here in the United States and not have it be in foreign countries, and that's,
unless we give it.
Well, we could agree to disagree on that. I think the intent is to. I heard conversations about protection of personal privacy, and I just want to add on that people who avail themselves of, say, an offshore call center. It is in everybody's interest, all entities' interest, to protect information at the highest possible standards. If I'm operating a call center, say, in India, and I'm contracting with an American company, you bet my first order of business every day is to make sure that there's not a headline that says Indian call center loses visa numbers, because I'll be out of business overnight, and companies in this country will reconsider overnight whether that's a thing they want to do. I don't know that there's been evidence, or perhaps anecdotal, but I'm aware that in the United States, companies use call centers, use prison labor for call centers. And I guess I'm not trying to be humorous here, but would you rather give your visa number to someone in Bangalore, India, or to some guy who's in prison for identity theft? I do know that I think what's important is that people everywhere protect people's private information, and that there are systems in place to do so, whether the person who's picking up that phone is in Alabama or Bangalore.
Thank you very much. I'm going to have to move on. I apologize, but the testimony is tending to linger on a little bit, and I got a lot of people who would like to testify on other things as
well. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Appreciate your testimony.
We'll call you later.
we can debate this later. Next up, I'd like to have Duke Shepherd, please. And Mr. Shepherd, after you introduce yourself, hopefully we can keep our testimony short. I apologize for that, but I do want to cover some other territory today.
Thank you, Chair Holvey. I will be very brief because I've written testimony that you can enjoy at your leisure. I would just say it's encouraging to see the legislature in a variety of settings examining. Oh, did I say this? Duke Shepherd, AFL-CIO. We represent about 100,000 unionized workers and retirees across the state, including the 1,100 workers represented by the Communications Workers of America that were referenced in Representative Rosenbaum's testimony. It's encouraging to see the legislature looking at outsourcing on a variety of bills and a variety of committees. We think with 20,000 Oregonians employed in call centers and the growth of e-commerce that call center demands by customers and by businesses are only going to grow, and that the sole reason for having call centers overseas is about cheap labor and lax labor laws. So to us, the ability to keep those jobs here, to establish standards which may or may not induce different behavior, it's at least worth a shot to try to induce behavior that keeps jobs here or prevents them from going overseas or creates some jobs. More importantly, we think consumers deserve to know who is managing and accessing their data, and to have a say in who manages and accesses that data, and have a say in who serves their needs when they have customer service needs. So thank you for listening to my testimony, and I can try to answer some questions. And we would be delighted to work with Representative Nelson and Mr. Craven on addressing the prison labor issue. Absolutely.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I appreciate it. Next up, I'd like to have Ted Hughes and Roger Martin at the same time, if that's possible. If they're amenable.
Mr. Chairman, I wish you would have asked me that question. I would have said no, but that's okay. No. Well, he's all right. Good afternoon. Ted Hughes representing Dell Corporation. I'd just like to share with the committee, 2.5 years ago, Dell decided to place a call center in the West. They chose, of all places, Roseburg, Oregon. There was an abandoned or Albertson store on Stevens Street in Roseburg. They bought the property. They remodeled it, hired 225 locals to manage. And in my opinion, and I haven't heard this from Dell, but in my opinion, Dell would not have chose Oregon for that call center had this law been in effect. That's all I have to say.
Thank you, Mr. Hughes.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Roger Martin, and I represent Alaska Airlines, who in turn represent the Air Transportation Association, which is the alliance of all the airlines for the state of Oregon. We are concerned simply because almost all the airlines are international in nature. I think if you called the Alaska Airlines call center, you'd get the kind of service you're looking for. I can't speak for all the airlines. I heard the comments from the chief sponsor about being in Chicago. When I have that kind of problem in an airport, I go to the service center. United Airlines is kind of a pain to all of us, but all of us end up flying on it because that's the one choice you have going a lot of places. But they do have service centers in all the main airports that can answer those kind of questions. I wouldn't be calling the call center to find out when the next plane took off. I would caution the committee. These kinds of pieces of legislation sound good on the surface. Be careful that you don't end up with 5,000 calls from people who can't do business with somebody anymore because you pass legislation to shut them down. It's happened in the past in other areas. So I would be very concerned about. I support Jim Craven's comments. And just as an aside, I have a personal friend who is a man in lives in the Lake Oswego area who owns call centers. He had a call center in Lake Oswego. He closed it because he couldn't hire people to do the kind of job that he could get done in Seattle or Salt Lake or in Cheyenne, Wyoming, where his call centers are now located. So I find it a little difficult to buy the story that we have a huge opportunity for call centers when this man, who's a professional, couldn't make it work in Lake Oswego trying to use labor from the metropolitan area of Portland. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you for your testimony. I appreciate your comments. With that, I'd like to close the public hearing on House Bill 2836. And I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2513.
Is Rep to May coming or not? I thought she was.
Steve, would you give us a little overview of the bill?
Thank you, Chair Holby. House Bill 2513 prohibits a person from issuing a gift card that expires or has a face value that declines over time or with lack of use.
I can explain them. Do you want me to go down there? I don't want to stay here.
Why don't you go down and testify?
Okay.
That'd be great.
I'm happy to.
I'd like to call up Representative Bonamici first, please. And Bill Perry, if you'd like the opportunity to join her, that'd be just dandy.
I always like sitting next to young, beautiful women. So.
Who would you like to go first, Mr. Chair?
The good representative, please.
Thank you. Chair Holby and members of the committee, I'm here to testify about House Bill 2513, which I co-sponsored with Representative Tomei. We've been working on sets of amendments to address some of the concerns that were raised in the other public hearing on this bill. What we're going to talk about today are the Dash 2 and the Dash 3 amendments. The Dash 2 amendments incorporate everything that was in the Dash 1 amendment, so those no longer need to be considered.
What we attempted to do was to break this out into two different categories. If you recall, there was a concern about some of the gift cards that are donated, given out as promotion or to, for example, schools or nonprofit organizations, or frankly, anybody who asks for them as a donation for business promotion purposes, those are donated. So what we attempted to do is break those into a separate category by redefining gift cards that are sold. So we changed the language in line 11. A person may not sell a gift card. So we have gift cards that are sold and then gift cards that are donated. That issue was addressed with the Dash 2 amendments. We also took out the language pursuant to a concern raised by Mr. Perry, and Representative Tomei and I were fine with this, and I hope you will be as well. With regard to the requirement that it be a charitable organization or non-profit corporation for use in fundraising, because, for example, the business might not always have the time or the inclination to ask, well, is this a charitable organization? Is this a nonprofit? If they want to donate, they should be able to donate without that concern. We still retain the requirement that the gift cards cannot decline in value if they're sold. And we retain the requirement that they cannot expire unless they are the donated or sold at less than value. We agreed to that the gift card does need to have in at least 10-point type the words expires on or expiration date. We don't care if it's on the front or the back of the card, and that's addressed in the Dash 2 amendments. The Dash 3 amendments, which Representative Tomei requested, are intended to exclude the gift cards that apply to more than one store. For example, the if you go to the Lloyd Center or the Clackamas Town Center or Bridgeport and you get a gift card for the entire shopping area, Rep. Tomei wanted to make sure that those were excluded. But this will address the concerns that were raised about, for example, there was a book card. I have to add that after our public hearing and the prior public hearing on this bill, I went home and looked at my Starbucks gift card that I had been carrying around with me for quite a while, and I turned it over and for the first time ever read the fine print and discovered that after a year, they will deduct $2 a month from the gift card until it's completely depleted unless prohibited by law. So I'm happy to say that when this bill passes here in Oregon, that won't be... It will be prohibited by law, and a card that you buy will not decline in value because of non-use and will not expire. So if there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. If you want to wait for Mr. Perry's testimony, that'd be fine.
Any questions of Representative Bonamici? Representative Gerard.
Very quickly, I had marks that I was very supportive of this bill until the Education Association addressed the bill that they were interested in the money for gift cards that were not cashed in. This in no way opens the door for that issue.
That's not an issue in this bill. I'm sorry. Chair Holby and Representative Gerard, that's not an issue. Said no better.
I was about to reprimand you, but Representative Nelson.
Yes, thank you, Representative Bonamici. I'm worried since I was a co-sponsor of this bill, and I think everybody remembers my testimony is primarily as an auctioneer who deals with these type of things all the time. And I'm very, very upset now because I don't think you can tell me that I can't sell my card. I think I've got that privilege, just like I can sell anything.
Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, I'm not quite sure I understand your concern. This doesn't say that you can't sell a card.
Oh, okay. The way I was reading this, it's Section 2, Line 11, except as provided Section 3 of this 2007 Act, a person may not sell a gift card.
That has an expiration date or that has a face value that declines as a result of the passage of time or lack of use of the card. You can sell a gift card, but you can't sell one that has an expiration date or that has a face value that declines as a result of the passage of time.
Follow up. Representative Bonamici, my car isn't worth what it was when I bought it, but I can still sell it. So I just think, you know, we need to think of that.
About cars. I think I understand.
Chair.
Yeah.
Chair Holvey and Representative Nelson, I'm not quite sure I'm understanding the issue.
I think I understand.
Representative Galizio, you understand.
Yeah, no, I think it's an interesting... In other words, just because of inflation, the worth will decline because of inflation. So in other words, if you buy a... Over time, it's inevitable that... The worth of the card over time will decline in value, even absent them subtracting it. Is that what you're saying? So, in other words, concern that the language is such that it doesn't take into account just normal inflation. I don't know if that's an oxymoron. Normal.
Is that Chair Holvey and Representative Nelson? Is that your concern? Just that it may, for example, if I buy a $20 Starbucks card this year and then next year the lattes are a dollar more a latte, my card is worth less?
No,
is that your concern?
Let's say I get a $50 card from Macy's and it buys this year, I can still... Where I see this, I couldn't sell my card if it changes in value. That's how I read this.
Can I try?
Thank you.
Representative Riley first.
Let me take a stab at this, if I may. My belief is that your concern is still with the donated cards that you're selling at auction. Is that correct?
Right.
That's the issue, is still the donated cards, and the way the bill reads, a person may not sell those cards. And what really is meant by the bill is the distributor, the maker of the card, the person who, the retailer, may not sell those cards, may not sell the cards that expire. Your concern is with the donated cards that you as an auctioneer are selling for a charity or whatever. Is that correct?
Right. Is that the concern?
That's the concern.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair Holvey and Representative Riley and everyone who's tried to enlighten us.
Yes, you are still in there.
Can I take a stab at this? For the record,
Mr. Perry.
For the record, Bill Perry with the Oregon Restaurant Association. We fully support the Dash 2 amendments and appreciate Representative Von Michi and everybody working with us on these. Basically, when you look at the definition of gift card, it still says in line 7, the issuer. So me, as a restaurant, I cannot sell a card that I don't promise as the issuer to pay for it. Okay, so the issuer, I think, is the claim here. On a auction or whatever that was brought up in the past, the issuer is not selling the card. The issuer, I'm donating that card, so it would not apply. So the issuer is not selling it, so it falls into the second category because I donated it as the issuer. So I think that what it says is me as a restaurant, I cannot sell. If I sell a card, then I have to honor it, no matter what. I can't take money away from it. I can't expire it. I can't do anything else. If I donate it to somebody else, no matter what they do with it, then there are parameters that I can put on it, but I obviously have to, if there's an expiration date, I have to state it. I think it's ultimately what has to put on, and I can't expire before 30 days. But this will still... And one of the reasons why we wanted that in Section 2 is because I will say as a restaurant association, I send out a letter to all my members and say, send me a bunch of gift cards because I get asked for them for golf tournaments or anything else. And so they send them to me. They don't necessarily know what I'm going to do with them in the long run. Those will be able to have expiration dates no matter what ends up going for them. But if a consumer ever pays cash to the issuer, which would be the restaurant in these cases, the restaurant has to basically make sure they reimburse every penny of that. They can't take $2 off 10 years from now. They can't do anything. If a consumer buys it from the issuer, they have to make sure they get every penny back. So this bill does, anytime you go to a retail establishment and pay cash for or credit or pay for a gift card, then this ensures that they will be able to get every dollar back. Now, it may lose value over time, but I can't take a service fee. I can't take any money away from that card under this bill.
Chair Chair Holvey and Representative Nelson, I hope that addresses your concern. It certainly isn't our intention to preclude auctioneers from just selling something. And if
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
We don't have to belabor this issue. It's just that there's so much of this in the state. So I just think we have to be really careful. It was my understanding that when we were going to amend this bill, that what we were going to do is to make them a type of currency, like a credit card from Macy's or Nordstrom's. That what we were going to talk about was strictly that type of a gift card versus all these others, these gift certificates, there's just thousands of different types. And I don't see that we've done that. If we had done that and with the amendment, then that's fine. You know, because Macy's can decide how they're doing business and decide their terms and expiration dates and so forth. But I don't see that we've done that. Didn't we talk about that?
Well, I think it was brought up. Chair Holvey and Representative Nelson, if we want to have a further discussion about this, I suggest we do that and have a work session on this at another time, if that's amenable to the chair.
We'll see if we can solve your problems. Any other questions? I'd like to bring up Representative Tomei at this time, and she snuck in without me noticing.
I'll just take my chair.
Okay. They were State Representative Carolyn Tomei, House District 41. Thank you. They were doing an admirable job. I don't think I need to add anything. I understand, Representative Nelson. I think that this bill does what it is you and I both intended when we were co-sponsoring this bill. I think what we've done also is alleviate the concerns that other people, including the Restaurant Association, have. When they give a gift certificate, they want to have maybe one that you will be auctioning off. They want to have some parameters set on that. It can be used in 90 days or a year or whatever. Whereas we're saying, and the issues that you and I both are concerned about is a gift card is going to be full value. If I pay for one at Macy's, if I get a $100 gift certificate, that's going to be worth $100 forever and ever and ever.
Okay.
Okay?
And it's
okay.
The face value.
If we, correct. Exactly. I think we said that. Yeah.
I think we're talking about the face value.
Correct.
As
correct.
Opposed to some other value.
Yeah. But we had to satisfy the Restaurant Association and others that were concerned if they gave a gift certificate that it's not fair to hold on to that for 10 years. They can set a time limit on that.
Okay.
Okay?
Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Torrey, can you briefly explain to me why you want to exclude the shopping center cards?
The Dash 3s.
Well, we were asked to do that. I got that. Thank you. I'm not sure who did this.
I don't know. I thought you
did. Did you do that? Oh, I know. Okay. I'm trying to go back and remember who asked for this. Apparently, there are in some shopping centers you can buy a card that will work for all of different businesses, and including credit cards like Visa, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So we do not want to include those.
Why?
Well, people had some objections to that.
If it has a value and you paid full value for it, I don't understand why it would be just because it's to one or more store. I don't understand. I frankly can't support that amendment. I think that's, you know, it's the same kind of card. It's a retail card sold by a retail organization, and just because it happens to say anywhere in this shopping center doesn't make it any different than saying any Macy's. I don't get that.
Chair Holvey, Representative Riley, I understand your concern. However, in order to pass the bill, as you know, in many bills, you have to make concessions, and this is one of the concessions that we were willing to make in order to get a bill through this committee.
Just one question.
Representative Nelson.
Just one quick question, Carolyn. We have, and I'm sure it's other communities too, but often our youth groups sell this card. I'm just tagging on to Representative Riley, and it's a merchant card, and for, I don't know what it was selling for, $50, I get $200 worth of something, gas or car washes or materials or whatever. So what we're saying is that card would not qualify.
That's correct.
It's already covered under the other portion.
Okay.
Not full value.
That's right. It's not full value.
Right. Chair Holvey and Representative Nelson, that would not be a gift card under this definition because it's not sold for full value.
Thank you. Representative Gilliam.
Mr. Chair, we could talk about this all day, and apparently we have. I just want to move on and point out to Chair Holvey and Chair Tomei that these make excellent gifts for good committee members. Thank you.
But not over
especially
$10.
To the chair.
But not over $10.
Thank you for that comment. trying to keep me on the schedule. I really do appreciate that, Representative Gilliam. And any other further questions or comments about this bill?
Oh.
Representative Tomei, any parting comments? Or?
Well, I think we've worked it to death, as we're certainly capable of doing. I think it is a good bill. I think we've tried to meet almost everybody's concerns, and I think the main issue is that when somebody buys something, mm-hmm. they should be able to get full value out of that gift card. So good bill should pass.
Well, with that, thank you very much for your testimony, and I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2513, and I would like to open a work session on House Bill 2513. And Representative Riley, would you like to make a motion on an amendment to adopt?
Mr. Chair, I move that we attach the Dash 2 amendment.
Thank you. Representative Riley moves the adoption of the Dash 2 amendment. Any discussion? Any objection? Dash 2 amendments are adopted. Representative Riley, another motion?
No.
I'll move the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2513, but then I'd like to have a discussion about whether the other committee members want to have to deal with that Dash 3 amendment.
Representative Bonamici moves the Dash 3 amendment to House Bill 2513. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Mm-hmm. Representative Nelson?
Okay. I'm just... Are Blazer tickets, gift cards?
No.
Okay. So if you have season tickets that you bought, this
isn't a jerk. No. Okay. The Dash 3 amendments only apply to exclude the gift cards that are usable with more than one seller of goods or services.
No matter whether you bought it for full value or not.
Well, because it's amending the definition of gift card, it applies, it's in line 9, so... It excludes, does not include gift card usable with more than one seller of goods or services.
Well, and I'm going to take the chair's prerogative. I don't think we really have a clear idea of or consensus on this committee for the Dash 3 amendment, and I believe that could be worked on the Senate side, and I'd be real comfortable with the Dash 2 amendments, but not. I don't think the committee's really totally in favor of the Dash 3.
That's
so,
fine.
And that's kind of my point of view.
Since there's a motion, do we need to have a...
You can withdraw it.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to withdraw my motion that we adopt the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2513.
Representative Bonamici moves to withdraw the motion to adopt the Dash 3. Any objection? Seeing none. Do I have a motion on the bill, please?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2513 as amended with the Dash 2 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Bonamici moves House Bill 2513 as amended with the Dash 2 amendment to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I think this has just become a revenue bill. It needs to go to the Revenue Committee.
No revenue impact listed.
Isn't it going to be for the school fund?
No, it has nothing to do with the school
fund. Okay.
So I do think that Representative Gilliam would like to talk about the bill a little more.
Emily, could you call the roll, starting from my right-hand side, please, and working your way back here, except for me?
Aye.
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 Aye. House Bill 2513, receiving the majority of votes, is declared passed. And with that, I would like to assign Representative Tomei to carry the bill, if you would.
Oh, thank you.
With that, I'd like to close the work session on House Bill 2513 and open a public hearing on the long-awaited House Bill 42, and I apologize for those that are waiting for that bill. We can go on and on. Steve, give us a brief summary of the bill, please.
Thank you, Chair Holvey. House Bill 3242 creates categories and levels of construction contractor licensing.
First up, I'd like to have Craig Honeyman, Larry Sitz, I believe, and Andrew Beyer, and Jessica Adamson. Thank you, gentlemen, for your patience this afternoon. Sometimes we take a little longer to get through things than others. But I appreciate your patience, and if you'd state your name for the record and talk to us about this bill.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to be here today to testify on behalf of the 1,100 members of Associated General Contractors of the Oregon Columbia Chapter. My name is Craig Honeyman. I'm the Executive Director of this Commercial Construction Trade Association, which represents contractors throughout Oregon and Southwest Washington. We have spent the last 18 months working on commercial construction license reforms contained in House Bill 3242. We began this effort to accomplish two tasks. One, to raise the standard of practice in the commercial construction industry, and two, to create a statutory distinction between commercial and residential construction. AGC believes it's time for Oregon's licensing law to reflect that the commercial and residential construction are two very different sectors of one industry. The fundamental difference stems from the reality that commercial contractors are in a business-to-business relationship, while residential contractors are in a business-to-consumer relationship. The consumers of construction services tend to be of commercial construction services tend to be more sophisticated than their residential counterparts. When we look at the consumer protection that are in the statute, we agree that they are valuable for residential owners who may not have the knowledge and expertise to understand lien laws and contract language. But those same conditions do not necessarily apply on the commercial side. Our owners have lawyers. They do a good job of protecting their clients' interests. We also have plenty of attorneys, and likewise, who negotiate on our behalf. But the process is fundamentally different. Performance and payment bonds, multi-million-dollar insurance requirements, indemnity clauses are all commonplace. Our owners know what they want, and they know how to negotiate to protect themselves. This is very different than in the residential industry, and we think it's time to make the law fit that reality. During the course of our deliberations, we looked at contractor licensing statutes throughout the United States, including those of California, Arizona, Nevada, and Georgia. We took the best of what we saw, revised them to make it work in Oregon, and added a few ideas of our own to put a package of reforms together. I want to also point out we've received valuable input from other industry stakeholders, including Associated Builders and Contractors, the Independent Contractor Electrical Contractors Association, the Oregon Remodelers Association, SMACNA, the Oregon Surety Association, Oregon Association of Minority Entrepreneurs, NAMCO, and the Hispanic Chamber. We'd also very much like to thank the Oregon Building and Construction Trades Council for their input and also their agreement to co-request this bill with us. All of these partners contributed to giving us valuable and honest feedback as we refined this proposal. And I particularly also want to thank the Construction Contractors Board and Craig Smith, who continues to work with us on this bill. They've been extremely helpful, and their assistance has made this bill even better. Thank you for the opportunity to present this bill. I'm now going to invite Larry Sitz of Emmerich Construction, an AGC member and chairman of our legislative committee, to begin to walk you through some of the details of the legislation.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. Thank you for my opportunity to share with you some of the specifics in House Bill 3242. I am Larry Sitz. I am the president of Emmerich Construction. We're a commercial contractor. We've been doing business in Oregon since 1943. And we do school construction, historic renovations, cultural projects, prisons, seismic retrofits, including the dome here. We did the public service renovation, state library renovation here on the mall, and the state archives building, if anybody remembers it. But we just built it. We didn't choose to put expensive carpet in it. I am a past president of the AGC, and I'm currently the chair of the legislative committee, and I was the chair of the task force that produced this bill. With your indulgence, I'll attempt to explain the detail of the bill and maybe more importantly why we are choosing to do what we're doing with each of the parts. My colleague, Mr. Beyer, will then talk about changes we've made for contractors post-licensure, and we'll attempt to highlight some of the changes that will be made in the amendments that we've already agreed to with the CCB and other interests. We're currently working on these amendments, and we hope to have them ready for you in draft form by Friday. So the bill is changing as we speak. Let me start by saying we focused on the changes to the commercial side of the industry. We've not proposed any changes to the residential licensing process. AGC understands there's a lot of discussion going on around the Construction Claims Task Force, and the recommendations from it will have a fair amount of effect and a great utility on the side of the residential contractor and the residential consumer. We've not incorporated any of those concepts into our drafts, and we don't think it would be appropriate to insert the changes for the residential industry into our bill. We're working on commercial, and we're working on the separation between commercial and residential. Additionally, we're working with the current framework of the definition of large commercial, small commercial, and residential structures that's already codified in ORS 701. House Bill 3242 makes no recommendations for changing those definitions. For your benefit, those definitions have been provided to you. How do we do that? In the back of your packet. We wanted to create a new set of licenses specifically for commercial contractors. The bill as written creates two new categories of licenses, one for general commercial contractors and one for specialty commercial contractors. Currently, the CCB licensing scheme provides for general contractors and specialty contractor licenses. We want to replicate that with a commercial emphasis. Also created two levels of licensure within each classification, a level one classification and a level two classification, the level two being for emerging and entry-level contractors. During the process, as we found ourselves trying to raise the bar, we were pulled between creating something that was going to be exclusionary. And so we created the level two classification to make sure that entry into the construction industry was not prohibited by what we were doing. Balancing the two needs led us to the creation of a level system where we set standards of standards differently based upon the level of licensure a contractor would choose. We've specifically not limited the amount of time a contractor may stay a Level 2 contractor, nor have we limited the amount of work a Level 2 contractor may bid or perform. Additionally, the bill prohibits a public agency from limiting the bidding pool based upon the level of contract licensure. We want to encourage contractors to grow to become Level 1 contractors, but not impede their progress by placing artificial time or bid limits in the process. We really wanted to pursue the requirements in Level 1, but felt strongly that those requirements would shut the door on emerging businesses, and so we created the two-level system. We believe, from a marketing point of view, contractors will stand up to try to become Level 1 contractors because they can say, I'm a Level 1 commercial contractor in Oregon. In the amendments, we're working with the CCB to clarify that contractors will not have to obtain two different licenses, which is what the original bill says. They'll obtain one CCB license with an endorsement as either as a residential, a commercial, or a residential commercial contractor, a combined contractor. This will make administration much easier for all, and we appreciate CCB's assistance in showing us that this would help the state a lot. We're pursuing new bonding levels for all commercial construction in House Bill 3242. The bill requires general commercial contractor Level 1 to obtain a $75,000 license bond. It's currently $20,000. A Level 1 specialty commercial contractor obtain a $50,000 license bond. The bill currently calls for all Level 2 contractors to obtain a $25,000 license bond. After discussions with NAMCO and the Hispanic Chamber, we agreed that Level 2 licenses would either go to $20,000 or whatever this committee comes up with for the new bond requirements for residential contractors in the state of Oregon. The ability of a firm to obtain a bond is an indicator of the financial strength of that contractor. Today, the license bonding requirements are at a level that really doesn't make a surety company spend any time looking at whether they're financially stable or not. They essentially just take the money. There's very little underwriting occurring, and so we support raising the bond level to make sure that the underwriting is actually occurring, that the surety company looks at the financials of a contractor. And in our discussions with them, they agree that at $75,000, they'll begin to take interest in writing the license bond and finding out the financial status of the contractor. Under the category of experience, all startup firms struggle to make it through the first years. Lack of understanding of risk and technical knowledge of the industry in which the startup begins is a factor in their success or failure. We want all new contractors to succeed. It's in no one's interest to have a new contractor fail on a job. It hurts the owner, other contractors, the subcontractors, labor, suppliers, and clearly industry, the construction industry in Oregon. Puts job behind schedule, makes life difficult for everyone, not the least of which the contractor that went out of business. We believe having experience as either a contractor or an employee in the field or some education in construction or business-related fields will help ensure these new companies do better when they start. And so it's part of the licensing process. The bill requires Level 1 contractors to have 8 years combined education and or work experience. Level 2 contractors would have 4 years combined education and or work experience. There's a chart on page 3 of 4 in this handout that shows how that breaks out. It shows different levels of education that will substitute for required experience. Contractors will be required to certify that they have an appropriate amount of experience among their key employees on the application form. We've agreed to some changes in the current draft related to this experience. The current language says that the RMI, a single individual, should have this experience. It wasn't our intent when the bill was drafted, but that's how it got drafted. we agree to allow the experience to be among key employees throughout the company. So if you have four key employees in your company, it's the combined experience of those key employees that's going to be measured. Additionally, at the request of NAMCO and Hispanic Chamber, we will be clarifying that work as an employee for a contractor counts as experience, whether that work occurred while they were journeymen or not. So if they're working for a contractor, that counts as experience. Under the category insurance, we've examined the current insurance requirements, and we are recommending additional limits for commercial contractors. We propose requiring general commercial contractors level one to obtain a liability insurance policy in the amount of $2 million aggregate. For level two, general commercial contractors and level one specialty contractors, we're proposing $1 million aggregate. For a level two specialty contractor, we recommend no change from the current law. The status of independent workers' compensation insurance requirements. Currently, there are two types of independent contractors in the Oregon commercial construction industry. Some independent contractors are true independent contractors. They're perhaps owner-operators, truckers, specialty artisans, and they're sole proprietors, and they really do work independently. And they provide a lot to our industry, and we don't want to affect them. Unfortunately, there's a second set of independent contractors that, at best, are skirting the intent of the law. And they are licensed independent construction contractors, but they work collectively, and they work for brokers or work in teams, and they're doing work in crafts like drywall or painting on a piece basis. We believe the practice is unethical and problematic for the industry. It undermines companies who are incurring the cost of having employees and providing workers' compensation and other benefits for those employees. And it puts at risk the folks who are actually doing the work without benefits of workers' compensation insurance. When an injury occurs on a job site, one of two things is going to happen. They either end up suing the employee or the general contractor, or they just walk into an emergency room uninsured, and the state of Oregon picks up their bills as an indigent injured worker without insurance. Either way, the state loses and the project loses. So we're going to require that independent contractors who want to become licensed do commercial construction, obtain a personal election workers' compensation insurance, and it is available in Oregon. It provides their protection then in the event of an on-the-job injury, and it's paid for as insurance and as a worker. It doesn't undermine their tax position as an independent contractor. It would simply make sure they're insured. From there, I'm going to turn it over to Andrew. And so thank you for the opportunity to give you the background of the bill, and he'll talk to you about other consequences.
Thank you for that run through the bill. It was very informative. And we're going to move on with another testimony. I know there might be a lot of questions, but I'd like to hear the next testifier.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this is my first time testifying in Salem on a bill. So you'll forgive me if I don't know the protocol, and correct me should I address you inappropriately. I'm Andrew Beyer. I'm the president and general manager of Walsh Construction Company, Oregon. And I'm also the second vice president of the Associated General Contractors of Oregon, Columbia. Obviously, I'm pleased to be here today. Made the decision to come down because I really believe that this legislation is critically important for our state. The system is broke. There has been a lot of construction that's gone on in our state that has not been done appropriately. There have been projects that have been built that have leaked. There have been, obviously, a number of lawsuits that have been filed over the course of the years, and I'm sure you have heard a lot about that or will be hearing a lot about that. Our overall goal, and the three things that I hope you take out of my testimony, our overall goal is threefold. The first is to improve quality of construction. The second is to improve the education and training and work put in place by people in the field running construction projects in the commercial area. And the third is to improve the warranty provisions that exist in the current legislation. So three goals: quality, training, and warranty. Walsh Construction Company is a homegrown construction company, been in business since 1961, was started by two brothers, Tom and Bob Walsh, as remodeling and a painting company. We have since grown into the fifth largest general contractor in the state of Oregon and the largest multifamily housing contractor in the state of Oregon. Overall, the company does about $300 million of business across those three regions. As Mr. Sitz described, we're looking for modification in terms of licensure because there is a significant difference between commercial construction and residential construction. Over the course of my career, I've done both. The residential contract would typically be 3 or 4 or 5 pages long. The documents that go along with that might be 20, 25, 30 pages. It is not unusual for projects that general contractors work on to have in excess of 400 pages of documents, drawings, and specifications, an additional specification book that might be 300 or 400 pages long. The contracts that we sign go through multiple negotiations and are very carefully crafted to balance the risk between the contractor and the owner. First, we're suggesting that in this bill that we require all commercial contractors to obtain continuing education. We believe strongly that the industry needs to continue to learn and grow and to improve our practices. It's very fundamental. Most of our successful contractors already do that. We spend hours and hours and lots of time training people in our business, and we believe and understand that that's a very important activity. We also think that it should be legislated, that that should be a minimum requirement for people that are in commercial construction. Larry has talked about the limit, so I won't belabor that, but the notion is that they should have a minimum, level one should have a minimum of 40 hours of continuing education per year, can be split among the key employees of that organization. A level two contractor, again talking about the smaller contractors, would have to have a minimum of 16 hours of continuing education per year. The education can come from a variety of sources, including but not limited to community colleges, trade schools, universities, trade associations, professional societies, and even in-house training. In response to concerns raised by NAMCO and the Hispanic Chamber, we're adding business associations and public agencies to this list. Contractors will be required to certify the number of hours they have completed in continuing education in the licensing period. AGC feels strongly, and Walsh certainly agrees with this, that continuing education should extend beyond just safety training. We spend many hours, and there are many requirements for us to make sure that our employees are safe and that we're not causing any danger to the public. However, we do believe that adequate training in construction methods, which would help prevent construction defects, is very important both to the contracting community and to owners. It's a positive step forward if we can include that in this bill. House Bill 3242 also requires a building envelope and penetration component warranty to be part of every new commercial construction contract in Oregon. I would guess it's a little unusual for a business to come forward to the legislature and request an additional to essentially double the warranty provision on projects that we put in place. However, that is exactly what we are asking you to do with this bill. The warranty would be for 2 years and would require annual inspections of the property. The purpose of the warranty and the inspections is to increase the likelihood of catching any issues that may have resulted during construction early so that they can be repaired. The terms of the warranty are not in the bill, primarily because they end up being negotiated with the owner and the contractor and wouldn't appropriately be in statute. So our goal is to raise the standards of practice in our industry. We believe this is critical. We can improve the work that's going on in the state of Oregon, and by ensuring that contractors are better prepared, insured, bonded, and educated, we believe we can go farther to help prevent the problems of leaky buildings in the state of Oregon. This bill is a major step in raising the industry up to a better standard of practice. There is another bill, 3241, unfortunately not in this committee, and I think it's worth mentioning that we operate in both the state of Washington and in the state of Oregon. And in the state of Washington, there is a six-year statute of repose. So the Bill 3241 is related to the business-to-business relationship that commercial contractors engage in. And we believe that this bill, 3242, goes a long way in creating a warranty that will help remedy issues early. And we are proposing that the statute of limitations be reduced from 10 years to 6 years. Again, we believe that this is a fair balancing of risk, responsibility, and reward. And while we understand that the committee does not have jurisdiction over that legislation, we want to put on the record that House Bill 3242 and 3241 were crafted as a package designed to better the industry and appropriately reapportion the risk. With that, I appreciate the opportunity to come and speak with you about the bill, and I believe Craig has some closing comments.
I will be brief, Mr. Chair, Representative, members of the committee. Again, Craig Honeyman, thank you very much for listening to our extended testimony on this important piece of legislation. As I indicated in my remarks, we've spent a lot of time on this, well over a year, in committee, in consulting with other stakeholders in the construction industry. We think we've presented you with a very solid bill. We understand that it may not be perfect in the eyes of some, and we look forward to the opportunity to work with them and you as members of this committee to further perfect this legislation so it can move along. Thank you for your attention this afternoon.
Thank you very much for your testimony, and you know, I really apologize to a lot of people on the time that's taken to get us to this point and in our meeting, because it is now pretty much over, and I really appreciate all the work that you've put into this legislation. I think it has great potential, and I'm sure Jessica can answer all the questions that this committee has about the technical aspects of this bill, and if she doesn't, I'm sure she'll get back a hold of you. I do intend on carrying this public hearing over to Friday, so we will hear the conclusion of this bill on Friday as far as the public hearing goes. So for those of you that want to continue this conversation, Friday is the day for that. And I really have nothing else to say. Any other comments from the committee?
I just want to tell Mr. Beyer you did an excellent job.
Thank you, Representative.
And I really appreciate it coming from the commercial industry, construction industry myself. I recognize the great impact you have on our economy and the fine work that all your contractors do. Really appreciate that, too. So thank you very much. With that, Representative Gilliam, you want something to say something?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'll look forward to Jessica's testimony on this. I'm particularly interested in the follow-up regarding the other stakeholders. But I wanted to ask Mr. Honeyman very quickly, can you identify for this committee for whom the Phillips head screw was named?
You know, I think I used to know the answer to that question. The answer is no.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Always willing to indulge
you
just once.
Why did I know something like that was
what
coming?
What is the answer? Please help it.
Yeah. Well, not at this time. With that, I'd like to close the public hearing on House Bill 3242.
And Joe Phillips.
Also, committee, we will be reconsidering what was the number? House Bill 2871 on Friday. So that'll take a little bit of time as well. And as well, we will not be hearing the construction contractor task claims force on Friday, if anybody's listening. Those are being carried over to Wednesday.
Nice haircut.
Thank you very much. It needs a little more work. With that, I'd like to adjourn the House Committee on Consumer Protection.
Susan.